Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm really excited for this interview about a book titled The Sounds of Spectators at Football, published in 2023. It's just out from Bloomsbury. And this book really goes into a lot of depth about something that I think a lot of people, either in depth or just kind of randomly through seeing TVs on in the background, actually have quite a lot of experience with, but maybe have never thought about, which is the sounds at a football, or to my American listeners, soccer matches. And not just understanding what these sounds actually are, turns out it's really interesting and there's lots of variation, but also how these sounds contribute to the overall experience of what a football match is for people watching, whether they're in the stadium or on television, and kind of actually investigating this thing that I certainly had never thought about despite encountering myself. So I found this a really interesting analysis and book. And so, Nikolai, I'm really happy to welcome you to the podcast to tell us all about it.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited as well, of course. Thank you for the interest and kind introduction.
No worries. Before we do get into all of the details of the book, I was wondering if maybe you could introduce yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book.
Yes. Well, my name is Nikolai Jørgensgaard Grokia, and I'm a Danish scholar from the University of Aalborg, or Aalborg University, situated in northern Jutland in Denmark. And I have... I've studied musicology originally, and then I studied psychology as a minor subject afterwards. And while the musicology studies were, of course, very interesting and useful, the psychology studies opened my eyes and ears to forms of sound and music that I did not pay much attention to during my musicology studies, to be honest, because I studied mostly... musical pieces or artworks that you can listen to with your eyes closed, so to speak. But the psychology studies opened my ears to all the sounds and music in our everyday life that surrounds us that we may not pay much attention to, but nevertheless has a great impact on how we see the world, to say it in a big way, so to speak. So that's kind of the background, you could say, my academic background for paying interest to phenomena like this one encountered in this book. And more specifically, I would say that I grew up watching football from England on TV as long back as I remember, as I was a little kid. The fact is that since 1969, the Danish Broadcasting Corporation, as a public service provider in Denmark, equivalent to the BBC, I guess, provided us with live football every Saturday from England, only from England. So I grew sort of into an interest to English football and have listened to numerous matches over the years as a kid. And then as a scholar, I sort of began to think about those, matches and the sounds of those matches, because they were very intriguing and nice to watch in numerous ways also. But the sound... of the matches then came back to me as I studied psychology and were grown up, so to speak. And then I thought it in a way natural to pay an interest to this in a scholarly fashion. And also then I started to look into what has been written about this phenomena beforehand. That's a good start, I guess, on any topic. And I found out that while there's a lot of comments on the importance of the sounds at football, there's actually very little scholarly insights into what are these sounds, what are the significance of the sounds, how and where are they distributed, and so on and so forth. So in a way, I thought there was a lacuna here to be explored, because I agree that the sounds are important and have importance and significance, but we need to understand what is the importance and how are they actually significant, these sounds. So that's kind of the background for me to pay an interest into this topic. Yeah. Hmm.
Thank you for explaining that. I think it's really interesting to kind of see the different strands that bring people to a book like this. And certainly having read it, it's not surprising to me that it was football matches and the sounds were something that you grew up with watching, because of kind of how the amount of detail that you pay to the spectator experience really comes through. But in some ways that actually makes my next question I'm even more curious about, because at least when I picked this book up, one of my immediate questions was, how in the hell are you looking at sounds of spectators in football, even if you're just focusing on the English Premier League? How are you looking at all the matches? I mean, goodness, that's a lot of football. How do you possibly get your head around this concept and not end up with a book that's, you know, 12,000 pages long? And so I then in reading the book, I was like, of course, case studies. Well, that's an obvious sort of methodological way in. So can you tell us which case studies you did end up using in the book, and how did you choose them?
Yes, you're right in that the phenomena is overwhelming in many respects. So my strategy was simply to pick a few cases and work out from there, so to speak. And and then I sampled a small handful or a big handful of cases based on partly on convenience, I guess, because as I grew up watching soccer, football on TV, I grew an interest or became a fan of Tottenham Hotspurs for various reasons. And I would say this is not a book on the sounds of Tottenham Hotspurs, but the sounds of Tottenham Hotspurs are, you know, the examples throughout and the case matches throughout. I guess you could say that there's nothing in a way. And maybe I'm hurting some Tottenham Hotspur fans now, but I suppose there's nothing really original about the sounds produced by exactly Tottenham Hotspur spectators. So I think the cases are pretty generic, you could say, generalizable to other cases, at least in England. So I chose the cases because it was relatively convenient for me to get access to the matches in England and to the televised versions of the same matches. So specifically, I have three pairs of matches, you could say, three games that I've watched in England. I was at the stadium myself, one Tottenham-Leicester in 2016, then a game between Tottenham and Liverpool the year after. And in 2019, I observed a match between Tottenham and Chelsea. And all three matches were at the home stadium of Tottenham Hotspurs. And then when I came home, I obtained a televised version of each of these three matches, so I could compare the sounds from the actual stadium, which I observed and listened to when I was there, and then compare the sounds to the televised version of the three matches. And these three pairs of matches were also selected because, as it turns out, and incidentally, I guess, Tottenham Hotspurs played at three different stadiums in this period, which made it quite interesting to, you know, listen to the same supporters, not exactly the same 40,000 supporters necessarily, but the same tunes and songs and chants and so on and so forth in three different settings, because the first one they played at the old White Hart Lane Stadium, which were then rebuilt, and during the rebuild of the new stadium, which is situated at the same location at the White Hart Lane Stadium. They played at Wembley Stadium, also in London, but some miles away. And then they returned to the new stadium for the last of the three matches. So there's three pairs of matches in three different stadium settings, but still the same home team. So that's quite a unique sample, I guess, when I look at the existing literature. This is quite original, and as I said, it opens up for some discussions about the importance of the built environment, you could say. And then I added, because of the pandemic, which unfortunately, of course, you could say, entered the picture at some point during my writing of the book. It was, of course, unfortunate in the bigger picture, but for me, in a sense, it was quite fortunate because it allowed me to include a match also played at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, the new stadium, against Liverpool, where there were no spectators in the stadium. So I was not there, obviously. I was not allowed to come there. But I had obtained a televised version of that match. And that was quite interesting because, as you probably know, they added, the television production teams added spectator sounds for that match and many others at this point in time. So all in all, three pairs of matches and then a seventh one inspired by the pandemic. So that's what I did and why I did it.
Well, that answer has raised a whole bunch of different elements of the book that I think I'm going to ask about in more detail. So first off, looking at these pairs in particular, you have developed, I found very helpfully, a typology of sound from the perspective of the spectators. Because I think one of the things that is clear, sort of no matter how you're watching a football match, is that there is a lot of sound, and quite often it's kind of unintelligible. It's all blending together in some sort of way. And if you're watching a match for the very first time, it sounds like chaos. And so quite helpfully, you systematize that chaos and explain actually what are the different components that are happening. So I'm wondering if you could introduce that typology of sound to us.
Yes, there's an overall typology of the sound present in the stadium and in the televised broadcast. And then there's a more specific typology of the sounds of spectators when you zoom in on those. If we start with the overall typology, then in the stadium setting, well, obviously there are the sounds of the spectators, but there's also the sounds of what I coined performers, those players on the field and the referee, most significantly. So that's another group of sounds. And then there's what I call organizer sounds that in the stadium setting would be, you know, the announcement system, the announcer, and also music played before, in between the two halves of the match and after the match. That will also qualify as organizer music. So these are three, you know, categories of or types of sounds that are present in the stadium environment. And these sounds are then televised in certain ways. And maybe we could get back to what is specific about this televisation or the televised product here. But in addition to those three categories, there are two other forms, one more important than the other, perhaps. But that's the commentators. Obviously, when you watch the match on television, there's a commentary, usually two commentators. And then there are also some sound signals or small musical signals to indicate, for example, a goal scored in another contemporary match. But these are quite rare sounds. So the commentary is the predominant television sound, you could say. So there's that's an overall typology of sound, and that's we could say more about that, but then as I said, more specifically, the spectators can also be typologized, the sounds of spectators, to put it shortly, I differentiate between music music sounds, that's obviously when spectators are singing, chanting, and apart from music, there are what I call object sounds, sounds produced by objects moving together. That could be a lot of things, but mostly at football and from the spectators, it's clapping. That's the prime example of object sounds. And then there are what I call just vocal sounds, as that is vocal sounds that are not music, not singing, but talk, chatter, shouting, interjections, ooh, or ah, or booing, or whatever. Sounds that are not, musical in the sense they have no distinct timbre or rhythm or anything like that. So that's three basic types of spectator sounds. And then there are some intermediate forms. Sometimes spectators clap with a distinct rhythmic figurations, and that is a sort of musical object sounds, I would say. And sometimes the shouting transforms into rhythmic shouting also, not just chaotic sounds like you mentioned before, but organized somehow in rhythmic configuration, and that would qualify as musical vocal sounds. So there are three main categories and two intermediate, categories, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And thinking about what you said earlier, it sounds like these categories are not specific to a particular team. It's not, these are the categories for Spurs fans. Liverpool fans would have different categories.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. The categories here are the same across English supporters, I would argue. Regarding object sounds, there's an important thing here, because normally and traditionally there's been no acceptance. Also, there's also regulations on behalf of the authorities and the stadiums. You're not allowed to bring in drums, for example, trumpets, or musical instruments. So the objects are the human bodies to a very large extent at English football. But in other settings, in Denmark, where I live, in Germany, in South America, and other places, there's an allowance and also a tradition for bringing in objects of various kinds to produce sounds, not only musical objects, but also other things. So I would say that while Tottenham Hotspurs are generic in the sense of representing, I would argue, English supporters, they're not generalizable to football spectators all over the world. And I read a little bit about that, but not much, because I haven't studied football spectators around the world.
Of course. So one aspect I wanted to ask about, again, that you raised earlier, is the idea that for the matches you looked at, Spurs were the home side, but they were playing in three different physical locations. And obviously, every stadium is different, is different size, is different configuration. And these are obviously quite different from each other. So what did you determine, kind of, not just what are the sounds that are being made, that you've helpfully explained the typology, but how can we think about the sounds being distributed in terms of kind of the location in the physical environment?
Yeah. While the three stadiums are all rather big stadiums, I guess you could say, there were significant differences. Because relatively, the White Hart Lane is a relative small stadium, including only about 35,000 spectators. That's a lot of people, of course, but compared to Wembley, where there were more than 80,000 people, it's a relatively small environment. And that implies that the sounds are more, in a way, more intense. Also, at the White Hart Lane, old White Hart Lane, the roof were hanging quite close to the spectators, which means that, for example, the sounds are not dispersed so easily, that they do not just vanish out in the open like they do to a large extent at Wembley Stadium. Because the roof is so far away, far above, and the environment is so massive, and there's so long distances between the spectators at one end and the other end, you can't really hear what's going on. And I guess the impression you mentioned before about sounds producing a chaotic, a muddled soundscape, that's characteristic of a stadium like Wembley Stadium, I would say. That's at least what I observed. So the built environment has a quite a big importance about in the way you experience the sounds and what you can actually hear, and the distinctiveness of what you hear also. So the built environment provides a sense of place. The way the sound, so to speak, provides a sense of the place, the sense of enclosure, the sense of intimacy, and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the built, the significance of the built environment. Obviously, this also the importance of the built environment also has to do with where are you situated within that particular built environment. And that's also a locational, of course, issue. And while the stadium as such give you a sense of place, the location of your point of audition, you could say, from where you're listening, offers you a sense of being placed in that environment. And that has great importance to, of course, what you can hear and what you do not hear. That's in a way quite obvious, but needs to be analyzed and taken seriously when describing what are the sounds in the stadium setting. Just to give you shortly an example, at the Tottenham Leicester match, I sat very close to the Leicester away fans, and all I could hear were the Leicester fans chanting and singing throughout the match massively in the relatively little White Hart Lane stadium. So while it was a relatively small environment, I could actually not hear the Tottenham supporters, because the Leicester fans provided us a sound wall, you could say, that refrained me from getting access to the sounds of Tottenham spectators. So the experience in the stadium were highly influenced by the production of sounds by the away fans, and that's quite interesting, because of course they are quite massively outnumbered by spectators rooing for Tottenham Hotspurs in the stadium setting. But my particular point of audition did not allow me to appreciate that. But then when I listened to the televised broadcast, I could hear very little of into the Leicester away fans, and mostly the Tottenham fans transpired through the broadcast. So that's just a clear example of the importance of not only the place, but of being placed in the place.
Mm-hmm. And I think similar to that, it's, as you said, sort of an obvious thing, but nevertheless not always something we factor in when analyzing. Can you speak to the timing of sounds in terms of the placement in the stadium?
Yes. I develop a sort of typology here again. I guess I like providing some typologies here, but I think it's legitimate to say that some of the sounds produced by spectators are relatively irrelevant, so to speak, in terms of in terms of how they relate to match incidents. If we look at what's happening in the match, some of the sounds are pretty much unrelated, and I would call them loosely coupled. They emerge because Tottenham Hotspurs are playing a home match, and I provide the example of "Oh, When the Spurs Go Marching In." That's a regular tune, a signature tune, you could say, or a sound brand almost for the spectators of Tottenham Hotspurs. But that song emerges on numerous occasions throughout the match, pretty much unrelated to what is going on in the match. If Tottenham are leading the match or not leading or whatever is happening. So that's quite a loose coupling here. And then there are other sounds provided by spectators which are very closely coupled with match incidents. For example, if a free kick is performed on one of the home team players, the spectators rooting for Tottenham will of course, you know, boo and provide a lot of interjections. Or if a home team player attempts to score a goal but misses by a small margin, the whole stadium or Tottenham Hotspur spectators at least will you know provide some interjections to accompany that big chance, and so on and so forth. And these are examples of sounds that are very closely coupled with match incidents, and actually these sounds are mostly interjections, while the loosely coupled sounds are mostly songs and singing. I think that's in more than one respect an interesting observation, because sometimes you hear commentators say that, well, the atmosphere, the mood at the ground can be monitored by listening to how much singing is there and what are they singing and so on and so forth. But actually, I would say the interjections are really an important part, perhaps even more important part of the atmosphere or the mood or the emotions or the engagements of spectators, because they are really intimate here and now, up in front, and follow closely the match incidents. So there's a topology here also on whether the sounds are loosely coupled or closely coupled, and again there's an intermediate topology here, a category of moderately coupled sounds as well. That can be, for example, if Harry Kane, he scores yet another goal, and then he is given a song by the spectators a few minutes later, you know, to a chant for him, for example. That's not very closely coupled. It's not loosely coupled. It is inspired by the scoring of the goal, but arrives a few minutes later. So that's a moderate coupling. So yeah, that's it.
So the example of the songs, I think is really important, because obviously a sort of famous characteristic of a lot of teams is, oh, they've got this particular song, and it is often sort of taken from, I guess, quote, a real song, sort of a pop song or something like that, and then might be changed. And it might be changed once, or it might be changed depending on whoever the star striker is, or it might not be changed at all, and it just somehow becomes that team's song, even though the lyrics don't seem to have anything to do with the team. And thankfully, you help us understand and clarify these multiple different ways that spectators engage with songs in particular, but sounds more generally. Use the terms adoption and adaption in the book, and I was wondering if you could sort of take us through these two terms and what you mean by them when analyzing what spectators are doing in this sort of thing.
Yeah, the concepts point at the general tendency for spectators to what you could say is a re-articulation of pre-existing pieces of music. They re-articulate pieces of music which also or already exist before the match, and that's pretty basic and normal. There are very few examples of spectators providing a new melody and new lyrics. Examples exist, but they are very few, and I didn't encounter any in my observations. So adoptions and adaptions are two forms of rearticulations. Adoption would be the one where spectators rearticulate a piece of pre-existing music without significant modification of that music. typically lyrically, the lyrics remain the same, so to speak. And an adaptation would be also a rearticulation of a pre-existing piece of music, but including a significant modification. Typically, the lyrics are changed somehow. Again, the aforementioned "Oh, when the Spurs go marching in" is a simple example, a good example of an adaptation, because it originates from the hymn "Oh, when the Saints go marching in," and then "Saints" are substituted with "Spurs," and then it's adapted for Spurs spectators, or for and by Spurs spectators. And adaptations are more prevalent than adoptions. Adoptions are pretty rare, actually. A famous example would be "You'll Never Walk Alone," sung by Liverpool spectators, Liverpool supporters, which is rearticulated in a way that the lyrics, as far as I can assess, remain the same as the original song. But there are few examples of that, but not that many. Adaptations are the normal, so to speak, form of rearticulation at English football. And adaptations are also a phenomena, a process whereby spectators can indicate, you know, their wit and humor and irony and so on and so forth, because they make up funny or witty or ironic lyrics for an existing melody. So the melody, actually, the pre-existing melody is just a carrier. And it's a convenient one because most people know this melody, but then the lyrics are what are being, you know, adapted for a particular reason at a particular match or so on and so forth. So that's the distinction between adoptions and adaptations.
Thank you for explaining that. I think those are examples, I think, that are very easy to understand. The "You'll Never Walk Alone," it's like, okay, well, what does that have to do with Liverpool? Don't know, but they've clearly made it their own.
Yes, yeah.
So an interesting one to look at. I sort of want to, I guess, ask the question we've almost been assuming. We've talked about how spectators make different sounds, where they make sounds, what the sounds actually are, but why are they making these sounds?
Yeah, good and big question, I would say, but it comes to my mind that they do that because they can't help themselves, so to speak. That's one reason, because when you're at a football match and you're engaged in the match and it's not just some sort of superficial show you're watching, but you're really rooting for one of the teams, you are engaged and excited, and then you can't help yourself. You grunt and interject and whatever at the match incidents. And also the football environment provides a sort of controlled environment where a sort of, quote, you know, uncontrolled display of emotions are the norm or okay. So that has to do also with traditions, that at football there's a tradition of producing sounds. And actually, if you don't produce sounds and sit still, watch the match, that's pretty unnormal or peculiar. So there's also a norm, not just a tradition, but also a norm of producing sounds that has become at least a norm. It wasn't always like that historically, but that's another matter. But in recent years, that's a norm. And a third thing that comes to mind is that, well, actually, at football, you can make yourself heard, actually. It sounds maybe a bit strange, but compared to other sports, like, say, basketball in an American setting, or handball in a European setting, or motor car racing, or whatever, you can, of course, make yourself heard or try to do so. But in these environments, you're competing with organizer sounds, as we talked about earlier. I mean, they play loud music. The organizers play loud music at handball and at basketball. So the spectators have to compete, so to say, with the sounds produced by the organizers. And at motorsport,
That would be an example where performer sounds, as the sounds of the performer, you know, the race car driver putting his foot down, providing a lot of noise, makes it almost impossible for spectators to hear themselves or at least any other than themselves. So you can make yourself heard. And that's also a reason why it makes sense to open your mouth, really, and make yourself heard, of course. And then I would say there are more specific functions, I would call them, as to why spectators performs, you could say, or make themselves heard. That's numerous functions here, but two of the most important I find is that one has to do with identity formation, that you not only make yourself heard, but you make distinctions about us and them. It's a pretty simple social psychological distinctions here, but nevertheless very important, that I belong to us, and we are this and this way, and we do not belong to those or them, and they are that and that way, very simply speaking. And there are numerous variations of how to taunt them, the others, how to praise oneself, and humor and irony can enter the picture here as well. But it all has to do, I guess, with some sort of identity formation issues. Another major reason why you produce sounds is has very little, if anything, to do with what is being sung, as that is the lyrics of the song, but has to do with the fact that you are keeping together in time, so to speak, or provide a sort of physical muscular bonding. You are, you know, common in the physical presence, in the immediacy of producing sounds. It's a collective endeavor, and that's very pleasing. Various studies point to that. That's a human, it's part of human nature, I guess you could say, to feel aroused, pleased with keeping together in time, clapping in rhythm, in a rhythmic configuration, or singing or shouting together. You sort of lose you sort of lose yourself, to put it a bit simply. You lose yourself in the group. You become something, becomes a small part of something much bigger, and you forget yourself also, and it's unmediated. It's a physical presence. So these effects and experiences are highly valued, apparently, and perhaps also that has to be seen on the backdrop of our highly mediatized society in general. I mean, we look at screens all the time nowadays, to put it simply, right? So that's the setting of the stadium, producing sounds with others in a rhythmic configuration, is not something that you can easily do in other settings. And as it is a pleasing, arousing experience, that's I think a very important answer to the question of why do spectators produce sounds in the stadium setting. Yeah.
Thank you for going through those reasons. I think it's a really good example of kind of putting names to things that we might sort of intuitively think of. But of course, if we don't have names for them, then we're not analyzing them very effectively. So it's helpful to kind of hear you explain them like that. But I obviously now want to turn to that idea that you've just raised, that kind of we look at screens all the time, everything's very mediatized, because you've already, in fact, given us an example from one of your pairings, that when you went to the match against Leicester, you mostly were hearing the away fans. But when you watched it back on television, in fact, you could then hear the Spurs fans. So obviously the experience and the sounds of football matches is quite different for spectators physically there versus watching on TV. But maybe you could tell us some of kind of the top differences that you notice between the two and explain sort of why you think those things are so different.
Yeah. Yeah, in the televised broadcast of the match, there's certainly not as much a sense of place and a sense of being placed as we talked about earlier. And that's, technically the result of the television production teams using multiple simultaneously operating microphones. So there's numerous microphones around the stadium, and they are operating simultaneously and capture, you know, sounds from all over the stadium and blend them together in one soundscape offered for the television audience. So aspects of location are lost, so to speak. You can't hear from where the sounds are originating, apart from the general fact that they originate from the stadium environment. So that's, of course, a very big difference. And it also points to the fact that the televised sounds are, of course, not real. Maybe that's a basic and simple insight, but sometimes you can get the impression that the sounds are providing a clear sense of the atmosphere at the ground. And that's not quite wrong to say that, but it's not quite right either, because the sounds are a highly produced soundscape, which nobody in the stadium setting hears that particular way. When you're in the stadium setting, obviously you listen to the sounds from a particular point of audition. You are seated in a particular place, and the sounds produced by the television audience are not available to anybody in the stadium setting. So in a sense, I wouldn't say it's a fake soundscape, but it's not real. It might be realistic, you know, gravitating to something realistic, but it's a highly produced, of course, soundscape. And what else is that? I would say in the book, I liken the sounds to, from the perspective of the television audience, I liken the sounds of spectators to the laugh track in sitcoms and stuff like that. At least it comes off like an internal audience. That is the spectators in the stadium setting, because it's an audience that watches what's going on, and it helps you as a television audience guides you to react to what is happening in the game. There are of course big differences between the laugh track and the spectators in the televised broadcast, and I write about these differences, but at least to see the spectators in the televised broadcast as a kind of internal audience, I think that makes sense to some extent. And interestingly, they function like what I coin an auditory seismometer, perhaps a bad metaphor in these times with earthquakes going on elsewhere in the world, but with this, I mean that the sounds of spectators in the stadium setting provides the television audience with a quite clear understanding of what is going on. Is it important what is going on now or not? And if there's a goal scored, who is the scorer of the goal? Not the particular player, perhaps, but is it the home team or the away team? You can hear that on the spectators, and long before, usually the commentators will tell you. So the sounds provide a sort of informative role to a much higher extent than they do in the stadium setting for the spectators, obviously. Yeah.
Can you tell us about that sort of mapping piece of it? Because I found that really interesting and had never really thought about how does that work?
Oh, the mapping, the sounds of spectators as they are, you know, obtained from multiple microphones around the stadium, the sounds of the home team crowd will predominate or be the predominant source of sounds. So if there's jubilation in the televised broadcast, that means that something good has happened to the home team or something bad has happened to the away team, to put it simply. That's a code, a simple code, but an operational code. So you can actually follow along the match without looking at it, and you don't even need the commentators. You don't have to pay attention to the commentators. You just sit and do something else and listen to the match, and you have quite a clear and good understanding of what is going on based on the quality of the sounds. And it's not so much about what is being sung, the lyrics of the song, because that's a major difference also, whereas you in the stadium setting are able to hear the lyrics of at least some songs, depending on where you're at. For example, I could hear the lyrics of all the Leicester away team fans singing. This dimension of the singing and chanting are lost to the television audience, almost lost. Sometimes the lyrics will transpire, but usually they'll get muddled because of the multiple operating microphones. So it's more the roar and the booing and the clapping and those sort of things, the optic sounds and vocal sounds that provides the television audience with a quite clear understanding of what is going on. So you're able to listen to the match with your back to the screen, and you could call this a sort of standby listening. You have a half ear to the match, and if anything interesting happens, you can hear the spectators beginning to roar or whatever. So and this is, of course, the commentators also provide information, but you don't have to listen to the lyrics to them. You can pay attention to something else. You can read a book. Actually, it's hard to read a book and pay attention to the lyrics of something, of some sounds. So that would be an example of a listening attitude that's quite functional. Which works because there's this internal audience, so to speak, of the spectators in the match, whose sounds are so simply coded and effectively coded that you can rely on them to a high degree. Yeah.
Thank you. I think the coding is really interesting because you're absolutely right, right? You can quite often sort of listen to the background and know what's happening because of exactly how this sound is being used, which makes it all the more interesting to think about your seventh case, right? When there was no spectators, there was no sound, and so there was fake sound. What did you, given kind of how in so much detail that you understand these sounds and have the different typologies for understanding them, what do you think of these artificial sounds and what can we learn from them?
Well, I think in a way that the sounds, the artificial or added sounds, actually highlights the fact that the spectators originally and always have been an internal audience from the perspective of the television production team and also from the perspective of the television audience. So apparently most television spectators or the television audience accepted to have these added sounds included, although it was quite obvious that there were no spectators in the stadium setting. That quite quickly became a norm, at least from the matches I saw from the English Premier League. I think it's not quite clear here. Some opposed this idea and so on and so forth, but the majority of spectators, you know, sort of accepted it, because if the sounds were not there, that would be even worse, apparently. So the sounds also have a sort of masking function here, you could argue, because if the sounds were not there, the game would sound like a training match or training exercise, I guess. The spectators, the internal audience, are highly important to provide a sense of something important is going on here. And if the sounds are not there, this importance is lost to the television audience. I don't think you can say that the sounds are that important to the players. That's, of course, debatable, discussable. But from the matches I saw, the quality of the game was not significantly lower. My point is that the players that played like they used to, simply put, But the television audience didn't like what they saw. They didn't, perhaps even more importantly, did not like what they heard. So they needed these added sounds. And that points to, I guess, the fact that this is from the television production team and an internal audience, and also from the perspective of television viewers. I think it's the process by which the sounds were added was also quite interesting, because the sounds were added from the computer video game FIFA 19, I guess, was what was the most recent version of the game at that point. So the computer game provided the sounds which were added to the live television broadcast. And the computer game FIFA originally obtained the sounds from various observations and recordings at actual matches before they entered the computer game. So there's a circulation here of copies of spectator sounds, which is, I think, also highly interesting in various ways. And there are two important things I would like to stress shortly here. The one is that the group of sounds provided by FIFA is a group of sounds which are FIFA-tized or sanitized or filtered, you could say, because they only include signature tunes for the relevant teams. But no offensive interjections or stuff like that, and no chants which are controversial. There are some controversial chants included also in the book. I mentioned some of them by Tottenham Hotspur spectators. They are filtered out, and so the soundscape provided for the pandemic matches, if we call them that, are sanitized and filtered. So that's one interesting thing. And another interesting thing is the way the sounds were deployed during the match, because actually a sort of DJ, I guess you would say, or sound operator sat in the stadium setting or wherever he or she sat. But the person would activate the sounds by pressing buttons at specific moments where the given sounds were appropriate. So when a goal was scored, the button with cheering was hit, and so on and so forth. And that worked only so and so well, I would say, because the sound operator was not able to provide this kind of meticulousness as the spectators, as the internal audience of the actual spectators at the ground were able to do. They would closely follow match incidents, and there would be no delays in their reactions. That's why a seismometer is, by any standard, a good metaphor or a picture about how they operated. On the other hand, the sound operator would often be delayed, and we're talking about half a second or so. A goal is scored, and then only after half a second is the button pressed and the jubilation occurs. Or to give another example, a home team player is knocked down, or a free kick is performed on him, and usually the home crowd will roar in disrespect and boo at the referee to provide a yellow card or whatever, and the sound operator would occasionally miss the button and not provide that kind of booing, or provided too late, so to speak, with a small margin of time lapse, but a time lapse enough to make the sounds unrealistic and obviously fake in the setting. So the case actually also points back to the importance of the regular, you could say, normal spectators in the stadium settings, who are much more meticulous and closely coupled with match incidents. So that's just two two points I would like to stress in this respect.
Yeah, no, very interesting points as well. And definitely, I think things that, especially in the pandemic, when there were so many people watching football who maybe didn't usually watch football, but there wasn't much else to do. I remember there being lots of very entertaining comments on social media about exactly those sort of gaps. Kind of being missed or coming in a different place, and really I think made people more aware of the role of sound in football as soon as it kind of became decoupled, I suppose, or unlinked in a way.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
which is really interesting. And of course, in a lot of ways, that kind of your book takes us really all the way up to the present, right? We still have every so often instances of matches being played without spectators. Obviously FIFA, the video games, the most up-to-date one that you've talked about, the chants and the songs and the sounds and the matches that you've discussed are very current. And of course, the book has literally just come out. So my last question might be a little strange.
Okay.
Is there, now that the book is done, is there anything you're looking to work on next? Or is it way too soon to ask?
No. That's that's not way too soon. Well, I have two things relating to this. One thing is I would like to look more or hear more into the sounds of sports in general. While writing the book, it became, of course, obvious throughout that the sounds of spectators and the sounds of football in general are unique, of course, original to the sport compared to, for example, tennis or golf or basketball or whatever. So that's one obvious way to develop some of the ideas here into looking at the soundscapes of other sports, not just the spectators, but the sounds of the sports, like the boot on ball in football. That's almost like a sound mark for the match, while the ping of the golf ball would be the equivalent, or the tennis, the hit with the racket to the tennis ball, and so on and so forth. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff to look into there. And then another issue, maybe related but not necessarily related, is the phenomena of sound branding, which I'm working on a book on, actually, also in Danish first, and then I think I will try to develop that into an English book as well. And sound branding, I think, is also an interesting topic. And I use the case of the car as an example. The sounds of the car changing distinctively these years with the electronic cars, emerging in great number, and how do they sound? How should they sound? How can they sound compared to other cars, and so on and so forth? So yeah, that's two things I'm working on. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Best of luck with those projects.
Thank you.
And while you are off exploring them, listeners can read the book we've mainly been discussing, which again is called The Sounds of Spectators at Football, just come out, published by Bloomsbury. Nikolai, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.